Hi everyone, this is Aisha Piotti and welcome to Navigating AI, a podcast on how to move the needle forward in AI policy. AI developments promise miracle leaps forward. However, they also present unprecedented challenges and can lead to major disruptions in the core fabric of our society. In Navigating AI, we interview key players from around the globe to speak about those challenges and how we can manage them. Our focus is on innovation in policy and governance. We survey the globe for inspiration, best practices, and success stories on how to build trust through effective governance and how to accelerate the adoption of AI for a better world. We take our listeners up close and personal with global policymakers, business leaders, top-notch academics, civil society advocates, and inventors to hear firsthand about their big wins and their suggestions for navigating the future of our next generations. In today's episode, we will explore the use of AI in education. We will discuss the implications and the role academic institutions can play to help us find the right balance between the risks and the opportunities of AI. So to discuss this topic, I'm thrilled to have with me Professor Elliot Ash, who is the Chair of Law, Economics and Data Science at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, ETH Zurich. Welcome, Elliot.
Thank you, Aisha. Great to be here.
Wonderful to have you. Elliot, people generally associate AI with programmers, computer scientists, yet you have a really impressive professional experience as an economist who also works with AI. So I think it might be good if you could perhaps share a bit about your background and also tell us what brought you to work in the field of AI.
Sure. So I would call myself an economist now. But before that, actually, my background was in law. And as part of my PhD research, I needed a way to extract information from thousands or millions of legal documents. And I couldn't read all of that. So I taught myself the tools of text analysis, and then computers could read the documents for me. After that, curiosity led me to the more advanced tools and natural language processing. 10 years ago, we could count words and phrases and relate them to other data points, like the political party of the judge or politician. Later on, we got tools that could understand synonyms and analogies, then syntax and grammar. But most recently, we have tools that can really read the texts like a human would, you know, answering subtle questions about the documents. And they can do it at scale. For many of the tasks that we do in academic research, that can fairly be called artificial intelligence. And that's why I'm using AI all the time now.
That's incredible. I mean, it's incredible how much progress this particular topic has, you know, done, and then specifically in recent years. But Elliot, you actually were based in the US, right? And then you came to, so tell us a bit about that. How did that happen?
That's right. I grew up in Texas. I spent my grad school years in New York. I was a year in Princeton and also a year at Warwick in the United Kingdom. And so I've been throughout those times in the areas of law, economics, political science. And I could see throughout that time period that there was this increasing interest in AI, how they would transform the economy, transform governance. But also how useful AI tools would be in the practice of research. You know, as I said, just in using text analysis to read tons of documents, to use machine learning to understand high dimensional data, to do a better causal inference for analysis of natural experiments, and we could see in economics and political science and law, all these areas of social science, these AI tools are also becoming more and more useful.
No, I mean, it's incredible, you know, and it's funny to see how I have a totally different background. But yet, if I recall, you and I, we met about 4 years ago, and it was incredible to see at that time that we shared sort of the same vision. So we didn't yet have a lot of discussions. I would say AI policy and governance discussions were still in their infancy. And that was when we decided, you and I, Elliot, I remember we met and we said, let's launch our global AI policy platform. Right? Which of course we'll speak about that in a minute. But I wanted to actually come to you on something which is on the top of mind for a lot of people, and that is of course ChatGPT. Okay. So as you know, everyone's talking about ChatGPT and of course similar generative AI systems. I mean, people I think today are struggling to figure out whether they should be really excited about this technology or should they be really anxious about this fast-moving technological development. And you're probably reading the news as well. You know, you have calls for moratoriums by big names such as Elon Musk, and we have sort of certain governments like Italy trying to ban it. But I was actually recently following, there's a lot of discussions in the academic community, right, about the implications and what's next. Certain schools I read were like restricting it, universities struggling to issue guidelines. So what would be really interesting is to know, what is your view about these developments in general? And what has been your experience so far with the tool?
Sure. So just to back up a second to provide set the stage, I'd like to point out, ChatGPT is the newest version of GPT, which stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer. That's just some technical jargon, but it more intuitively, it's a system that can generate language based on reading a ton of text from the internet. And for me, it helps to understand how these technologies learn language by comparing them to how kids learn language. I'm sensitive to this because I also have twins, as you know. I have 2 4-year-olds, and they're learning to speak right now. And kids learn, I can observe this, kids learn by repeating what they hear from adults and from other kids. And that repeating of language is how the earlier versions of GPT, up until 2021, were working. And that is already a really impressive development if you can have a machine that can repeat language and make it seems believable, like human-like. Mm-hmm. But there's something else happening when kids learn language. When they say something, they then see how adults and other kids react. So if an adult rewards the child for saying something, then they'll say it more often. But if the adult chastises or punishes or ignores the kid, chastises in some way, they'll say it less often, usually.
Mm-hmm. Exactly,
and
yes.
That last part of getting feedback is what the newer versions of GPT, starting with ChatGPT last year, are doing. And I think there's something deep here, because the older version of GPT was like a kid learning language just from watching TV or listening to the radio. And they might learn what to say, but they would not learn what not to say. And, we can all see together that the results of this new feedback mechanism for these AI assistants, the results are astonishingly good, and they'll just get better. So to get back to your question about how this is transforming academia, I think it's transforming society more broadly, and we're gonna see it more in the next decades. Just as an example, I was in Italy last week for a seminar, and I pulled up ChatGPT for something random, just looking something up. But the website was blocked, and the ChatGPT website, and that shows I am already taking this tool for granted. I wasn't, this is something as part of my normal work workflow. But on the other hand, ChatGPT is not the same as other tools that we have, like Google Docs or, Grammarly or Trello or something. And governments have well-founded concerns with whether there are needs for controls or protections. And the maker of GPT is OpenAI, the name of this company. But unfortunately, they have not been that open about how GPT works, the newer version, and in particular, what data it is trained on. And some other details of how it's built. And I would want more transparency on that. So just to say a bit about how this plays out in academia, and in particular, the first worry about how it affects teaching. And I think it's fair to say that most college students are now using ChatGPT or other AI assistants to help them in their coursework. This could be a good thing, a kind of like having a calculator in an advanced math class. So in that case, like if you're talking about kind of calculus or algebra, having a calculator is what I would say, I would call that complementary with learning. It supports learning. But using ChatGPT could also be a bad thing if it substitutes for learning. So if it's replacing the learning process, and that you could also compare that to a calculator, but in the more beginner math classes. So if you're trying to learn long division, but you have a calculator, that's going to interfere and substitute with learning. And so if you take that to, you know, college classes, for beginner courses and tasks, if ChatGPT can do the work and it's a substitute, then we can't really allow graded assignments with ChatGPT, because it will just interfere with learning, and it will interfere with the learning process. But before the test, before like the quiz, when you're actually kind of learning something for the first time, it actually could be useful to have ChatGPT, because you can learn, you can check your work, look things up quickly. And also, you know, just for the more advanced coursework and tasks, like at the master's level, PhD level, graduate level, I think we, you know, we arguably should be encouraging the use of ChatGPT in many tasks. So they have kind of a controlled environment for using it in their learning. And they should learn all of the capacities and capabilities, because they're going to need it to be competitive in the workplace after getting out of college.
But Eddie, that's exactly it, right? Because if I look at, you know, what people are looking at, they're saying, hey, but you know, there's all these news that says, well, actually ChatGPT has just passed the bar exam, right? Or ChatGPT has just done a PhD thesis and then gotten like 90%. Now, my question would be like, you know, how are these sort of, are you thinking about some rules, or as an academia, what is the view in terms of, you know, ETH, but also in generally in the academic community on how to find this balance? And are you going about it through some kind of, you know, internal governance mechanisms or guidelines, or that would be good to share?
Sure. There's a lot of discussions going on about this. And I think we're just seeing the beginning of it. There's a lot of worry and well-justified concern that the old modalities of teaching and learning are potentially out of date. Also, a lot of the things that we're teaching students now, you know, they were, what we were teaching them last year, they may or may not be useful if some of those skills are then, you know, replaced by GPT in the future. I mean, as you said, GPT-4 can now pass the bar exam. You know, there's I mentioned that many of my research tasks, cognitive tasks and activities, can now be done by the current version of GPT, and I suspect that will get even better over time. I would say right now, you know, you can't really have an AI lawyer on its own or an AI economist on its own, but I would hesitate to make confident predictions about whether that's impossible or not. You know, I'd say performing specific, well-defined tasks with well-defined instructions is something these AIs can do, but that's quite different from taking over the whole job of like a lawyer or a researcher. And because the job is not a well-defined task. It's especially for research or for art or something, you know, it's more kind of open-ended. And also research in other, many other work is not the product of an individual. It's the product of an organization. And so organizations coming together, that's a more complex set of tasks. You can't even really call it a task. It's a whole system. And so an individual AI, arguably, even if it can replace an individual, it might not be able to replace a whole organization.
Yeah, but you raised something which I really like, and I think it's quite core to also education, right? It's a point of skills, right? So we're sort of gonna have to. So on the one hand, you have, I believe, as educational institutes, gonna look at how do we balance between the use, because of course you'd like people to use, but on the other hand as well to make sure that there's still learning happening. But on the other hand, it's also, I'm assuming again, and I'd love to hear from you, if you are thinking that we could be moving as a society, but also in the education arena, to certain different skills, because, you know, I was reading that, GPT-4 can also sort of code, they can do a lot of those things that you sort of teach computer scientists. And so you and I, you know, being parents, for me, it was also important to see what kind of skills should we be looking at for our kids to develop, and how should we go about it? So any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a big question. I would say I could provide an answer about that, about how kind of GPT works now, but you know, that would potentially be out of date a year from now, or I don't know, 6 months from now, because it's moving so quickly. I do think that it's important to stay on top of these things, in the education field, not just at the college level, but also, you know, primary, secondary, how these technologies should be integrated into the education process, or how the curriculum or the skills that students learn should change, is something that, you know, we should have an informed debate about. This is the kind of thing that as you said, AI can now write code, it can now read documents and answer questions about them. This is something that previously you would need humans to do. But an AI also doesn't have like a motivation or an objective. And so we need to have humans kind of have good understanding of what are the capacities of these AIs, so that we can really focus on what humans are good at. But I will say that will change over time.
Exactly. And it's changing and it's evolving. And I think you brought in this one point, which I also wanted to talk about, and then which is linking also what I wanted to discuss with you afterwards, is about, you know, what we will need from other sectors of society, right? So this, you said, it's going to be a broader debate. Everybody has to sort of chip in and discuss, because this is something which is obviously evolving fast. And we as humankind, each of us has a role to play. And I mean, when you come to skills as well, I think, yeah, maybe some different types of skills are what we should be thinking about developing and focusing, but that will need work.
I would actually make one comment about that, because I think that's important about these different sectors in society. And I think that, you know, that's a motivation of our AI policy summit, of course. But as of now, a lot of the contributions to public debate about these AIs come from the companies that are developing them. And that is a risk of a conflict of interest with marketing and things like this. On the other hand, many of the speakers outside of the tech industry might not fully understand the technologies. And I can say just from my side that many of the editorials and op-eds that I've read about ChatGPT and things, they didn't understand how it worked. And so I think like that is, you know, results in a not very useful discussion. And so I hope that, you know, different stakeholders in academia, NGOs, who have a sense of how the technology works, can contribute to this discussion, so that a more informed debate in the public sphere, in the media, and then finally in policymaking can take place.
But you know, what you said is key, and I think that brings us to the next thing I wanted to talk to you about is, of course, you know, that there is a responsibility for people who understand this to share that knowledge, right? And I mean, now, and if any, this is the best time to do that. So now I come basically to your research, right? So tell us a bit about your research interests. And in particular, I think what is most interesting from my perspective would be to see how you see those researches linking to the broader picture of what's happening today with AI in terms of challenges and opportunities.
Sure. So we've been using AI, I've been using, and my team have been using AI in a number of research projects. For one, with some collaborators, we built a system for detecting public sector corruption in local government. And that's using data from Brazil, where the algorithm sifts through local budgets and you have hundreds of line items. And it can detect potential malfeasance, you know, misreporting of funds and, you know, stealing, things like this. And you know, it can detect it 100% of the time, so you can't send someone to jail based on what the AI says, but it's accurate enough to support decision-making, such as where to send auditors next time. And you can see how this is not just staying within academia, we're really trying to make it connect to the broader society. By we started a partnership and conversation with the Federal Anti-Corruption Agency in Brazil. And if all goes according to plan, some of our AI-powered tools will be used in practice by the anti-corruption agency to support the auditing and detection of local corruption. So that's just something that has you kind of immediate policy payoff for a well-defined problem. And you know, elsewhere in my research, that was kind of a policy, but more on the law side, the legal side. AI is useful in a number of ways. Perhaps one of the most well-known, but also most controversial, is machine prediction of recidivism or reoffense, whether a defendant who's, you know, for example, up for bail or up for conviction will commit more crimes or not. And this is part of the legal system in the US and elsewhere, is that judges often use perceived risk of reoffense as a criteria in their decision making. So you have these systems like Compass, which provide a prediction. They're not like 100% accurate, but they are accurate enough, but much better than guessing. And you know, there's controversy and there's risks, but our research shows that using these systems can help judges be more fair. It can help detect judge biases towards different social groups and to better understand them. And so this is a example of where using these AI tools can kind of help us improve governance. Going back to language models like GPT, I want to mention that I think these are some of the biggest developments in the law are going to be about legal language. And so, as you said, this is one of the big highlights of the marketing around GPT-4, is that it could get a good score on the bar exam. And in my own research, I've been working on legal summarizers. So tools that can read long legal documents and extract the most important points to help lawyers or judges save a lot of time. But then also beyond the law firm or courtroom, I'm also working on legal translators, so to convert legal language from, you know, technical legalese to more plain English, that will help everybody understand what arguments are being made in the courts, and the hope being to democratize the law. And I think that's one other opportunity that I hope that we as a society pursue, is that AI is not just for business, but can help democratize all technical fields. Not just the law, but also medicine and science, you know, monetary policy that is normally the domain of technical economists. I hope that AI tools like GPT can help translate this technical language and make everybody be able to contribute to this discussion. Mm-hmm. And in business, I think it's fair to say there's going to be a ton of startups using GPT and related technologies. And in the legal realm, I've advised two of them already. DeepJudge is a Swiss startup on smart legal search, and their company started as a course project in my class a few years ago, and now they're really quite well developed and well established, partnering with many law firms in Switzerland and elsewhere. Second, there's a startup called MidPage, which is a German startup, which is they're developing a legal writing assistant. So kind of like Grammarly for lawyers, but more sophisticated than that. For those who are programmers, it's comparable to like GitHub Copilot, for example. MidPage came out of a master's thesis that I supervised. And I think those are just two kind of early indicators, and we're ready to do even more in the future.
Incredible, incredible. So basically what I take away, Elliot, is that your research is targeting policymakers, right? So when you look at Brazil, you're looking at governments using the research that you're doing, and you can work closely with them. AI and justice is incredible. It's an incredible field. And what caught my attention was when you said, well, actually, AI can help detect biases, right? And I think we should remember these things. We should remember that we shouldn't only be looking at having the hat of, well, this is not right, this is not right. But on the one hand, yes, there are risks. But as far as AI and justice in the justice system, there is a lot of, and you talked about efficiency, and you talked about how we can do things much better, much quicker. And I like this whole the legal translator thing as well. And I'm assuming this would be used by whom, in fact? This, you would, you know, if you have somebody, who is going to be using that? The translators.
So for the legal summarizer, this is something that lawyers and judges could use. For the legal translator, this could also be used by lawyers and judges to help make their documents, their arguments more more readable by the public. In the US and elsewhere, there's a big problem with judicial legitimacy right now. And I think that the fact that law is arcane and esoteric is a problem, and most people in a country, most citizens don't know what judges are doing. They don't understand the arguments they're using. And I'm hoping that by translating legalese to plain English, we could improve the legitimacy of the judiciary, and that could be used by people or you know, by NGOs or even by companies who want to help people interact with the legal system.
AI and justice was one of the themes of our AI policy summit last year, right? And what was very key and what came out to me was the fact that there is, when you have judges that are in, I would call them the humans in the loop, right? Using even AI, there is a lot of expertise, there is a lot of knowledge, there's a lot of value judgments that they need to make. And I'm assuming that what was really the highlight for me was that that is what will be needed in the future in many other fields as well. And we need to be getting together and working on those skills and looking at how we can maximize all of this.
There is a risk that these AI tools, and that, you know, I was saying that judges can become more legitimate if there's more transparency on what they're arguing. The same thing for AI, right? If it will be more accountable and more trusted if we have transparency on how it works. So I think that that's why we should know what data it's trained on. We should have some explanations. We should have a human in the loop to try to understand, you know, where biases might come in. It's an important topic, not just a technical issue, but also a political one and social one, and a perfect topic for our AI policy summit.
Exactly. Now we're sort of slowly coming to a close. It's been so exciting to listen to you, Elliot. And of course, just for our listeners, I wanted to say a few words about our AI Policy Summit, which is an annual event where we bring together sort of top academics, business leaders, policymakers from all over the world to discuss and more so create policy and governance solutions that maximize, on the one hand, the impact of AI on business, but also on society. And so I'm also glad that, you know, the platform is growing and, you know, at such a rapid pace, a testament to, of course, the interest in the topic. And we have a summit coming up in November of this year. And I'm just wondering, Elliot, if you wanted to say a few words, anything else that you believe is important to be discussed in AI and policy in general, or some words that you would like to share with our audiences.
Sure. So how I see it is, the AI Policy Summit is a unique event. Most events will have people from academia or from tech companies or NGOs or from the government. And we have people from all of these domains coming together and making a discussion and a dialogue about issues of AI, both on the technology and the policy side. And I think it's fair to say that we have a head start, because we are now organizing the fourth annual summit. So we started this before AI went mainstream, just in the last few months. But you know, we should discuss, why did AI go mainstream? The big issue this time around and later this year is it will still be language models like GPT and its variants. Those are going to be transforming business and academia and government, and we will want to stay on top of that. So I'm really excited to see what discussions come out of that from all of these four groups getting together. So in particular, I hope that we can focus on a couple of things: how these AI assistants will change the job market, for example, what jobs are going to be boosted, what jobs will be transformed, which new jobs will be created. So I have a special interest in this because of my economics background, but also in the legal world, where, as I told you, there's these very interesting and exciting legal AI tools being developed. And how is that going to affect the practice of law? I think it's difficult to predict. On the other hand, there's a lot of hype about this. Some of it could be overhyped, and whether we have a robot lawyer or just a robot legal assistant, I'm not sure yet, but I hope that we can discuss that with the right combination of optimism and realism.
Absolutely. just to echo what you said as well, Elliot, I mean, I think definitely as far as I am concerned and what I feel strongly is that higher awareness and involvement of all actors of society is critical for these debates. And then I just wanted to underline also for our listeners that, you know, you don't need to be really an engineer or data scientist to be participating. And I think that our forum is open for all. And for policy specifically, since we are discussing and we will be discussing trade-offs that need to be made, the more we have input from different walks of life, different parts of society, that is going to be crucial to move the needle forward for AI policy for us. And of course, we need platforms in order to do that, that raise awareness. And of course, our AI Policy Summit is one of those. So it's taking place November 3rd and 4th, and we'd be really happy to please join us for that one. So many thanks, Elliot. I think this was, you know, really delightful to talk to you. Thank you for your insights, and looking forward to working together going forward as well.
Thank you, Aisha. I'm looking forward to the next episode.
Thank you. If you're interested to learn more or have questions that you would like me to cover in future episodes, please reach out to me via LinkedIn. You will also find links and more information about our guests, our community, and our annual AI Policy Summit in the episode notes.